On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, we are commemorating the 80th anniversary of the discovery of one of mankind's darkest chapters, the Holocaust. And when I saw this book, I thought, give an opportunity for the author to shed some light on this. The name of the book is How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust. Our guest is Dr. Dan McMillan. He is a German scholar. As a matter of fact, one of the things that intrigued me about the book is that he was so curious about why the Holocaust happened in Germany and not somewhere else, and therefore could it happen somewhere else, that he deliberately set out to learn as much as he could about the culture and has a PhD in German. He is here today to talk about what he has discovered in the research for this book, and hopefully to give us some insight and also some caveats as well. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today on the Bookshelf.
Dave, thank you so much for having me. It's good to be with you.
So you got caught up in this terrible saga from a young age and decided the only way to do something about it was to get as educated as you could so that you could then research?
Yes. I mean, I read my first book about the Holocaust just a little over 50 years ago, probably in January of 1973, the year that I turned 13, but I was still 12. And it was by Simon Wiesenthal, the famed Nazi hunter. It was called The Murderers Among Us. That
right.
was a memoir of his experiences and also discussed the careers of some of the leading perpetrators that he had brought to justice. And although I, of course, couldn't articulate why at the time, it kind of knocked me flat. And what I was only able to fully articulate later, really in the process of writing this book, and to some degree only in, you know, the 20 or so lectures I've given afterward at synagogues and Holocaust organizations, that what struck me so much about it, and which I think is the main reason that it frightens people so much, is that this is really the only moment in history where, you know, the rulers, the ruling class of a society, decided that human life had absolutely no intrinsic value whatsoever. I mean, as you know, every war, every mass killing, every genocide, the killers dehumanize their victims, human life gets cheapened. But in the Holocaust, the dehumanization of the Jewish victims was absolute. I mean, you know, for example, the way that they processed their bodies for value as if they were animal carcasses and used them as laboratory animals. And altogether, you know, this is the only large ethnic group to be targeted for complete biological extinction. You know, they saw the Jews as a virus, and you want to stamp it out everywhere so it can never grow back. Obviously, I couldn't put this into words at the time, but it really frightened me. Now, I don't want to give the impression that I came down to the breakfast table one morning and frightened my parents by telling them that I wanted to be a Holocaust historian when I grew up. But, you know, that when I got, you know, I really like foreign languages. I was studying Spanish. I got to high school. There was room in my schedule for a second language. The offerings were French and German, and I, you know, unhesitatingly spoke, you know, chose German in part out of my interest in the Holocaust, and then sort of one thing led to another, and, you know, my eventually getting my doctorate in German history from Columbia. And although I didn't write my dissertation on a Holocaust topic, I was, for all that time that I was studying history, I was always trying to put together bricks in the edifice of an overarching explanation.
It seems to me, having read your book, that the wisest thing for us to do is to look at several factors that are often not considered. One of the things that I have always thought was a part of it, and you do as well, is the fascination with the pseudoscience of eugenics in the early part of the 20th century, and how widespread it was. 17 different states in the USA had laws in the book that allowed for involuntary sterilization based on supposed tests that they were going to inherit something that the society at large said was undesirable and so forth. Germany kind of became the poster child for eugenics. They embraced it wholeheartedly. But that's not nearly the only reason that the Holocaust happened there, because as you point out, it could have happened, if that was the only reason, it could have happened in America, it could have happened in the UK, which also embraced eugenics, and only recently has basically shed the use of the name. So what was it about Germany that made it unique, even among the nations that were very involved in eugenics and genetic research. That certainly is a part of it, as you point out, but it's
not
the only factor, obviously. So you looked at the government changes, and I found this absolutely fascinating. So tell us how the modern state of Germany developed from the latter part of the 19th century into the early 20th century, and why that's so critical for us to understand.
Thank you so much for highlighting that. You know, and I really like the way, by the way, that you point out eugenics can't be the only cause, because it's Europe-wide and all throughout the Western world. And of course, anti-Semitism can't be the only cause, because anti-Semitism you see in every society.
Right.
That only in one side you have genocide. I think what was specific to Germany, ultimately, the politics that led to the rise of the Nazi Party and the Nazi Party coming to power, and this party being so dedicated to anti-Semitism and to Hitler's desire, you know, just fanatical desire to exterminate the Jews, really all comes out of the fact that Germany is unified in a series of wars engineered basically by the Prime Minister of Prussia, Otto von Bismarck, culminating in 1871. Almost all of the German-speaking states of Europe are brought together in this new German Empire, and Bismarck is able to do it in such a way, he has so much power because he's orchestrated it, with a constitution that is semi-authoritarian, where the balance of power is with a hereditary monarch. You have a parliament that has budgetary powers, but what you don't see in Germany that you see in historically was the case in France and in England, for example, that you don't see the elected legislature using its budgetary power to eventually take control of the executive, to take that away from the monarch. Probably mostly because the Germans, having developed in these different states, different principalities across centuries, and for other reasons as well, were an extraordinarily diverse society, and you had really five major political party groupings that were mutually antagonistic. And so the division of these different parties prevents them from coming together. So you have, among the German people, a lot of pressure for greater participation. You have a lot of pressure for democracy, but there's no way to bring together a majority coalition in the parliament. So the political system is stuck. You have this authoritarian system that is essentially fighting a constant rearguard action against democratization, and is successful in this because of the German people are divided against each other. And then the additional particular angle that proved to be so fateful and dangerous was that the most intense pressure for democracy came from the Socialist Party, which was a dogmatically Marxist party that predicted, you know, a proletarian revolution and the end to capitalism. And everyone is terrified of the socialists. And beginning in the 1890s, the elites of Germany, at all levels, who are all politically reactionary because they all benefit so much from this imperial system, their two weapons against socialism are sort of militant nationalism and anti-Semitism. The nationalism, and you get this increasingly bullying foreign policy by Germany that eventually is a major cause of World War One. And the idea is, let's just forget our class differences. Let's not be workers or bourgeoisie. Let's all be Germans. And the other prong of that was anti-Semitism. Jews were accused of being the instigators of Marxism. And there's a whole chapter on that. And that also is not unique to Germany. It was very widespread throughout Europe. In our country, Henry Ford, who was a militant anti-Semite, was constantly publishing conspiracy theories about the Jews as the instigators of Marxism. Anyway, what then happens is a very fateful sequence of events. Germany loses the World War. The armistice is signed on November 11th, and it's essentially an unconditional surrender because the German armies are totally outgunned and outmanned on the Western Front. But 2 days before this surrender comes a democratic revolution that's led by the Socialist Party. And this causes so many people on the right of German politics, and we're talking maybe 30% of the electorate and all right-wing politicians, and Adolf Hitler in particular, who blame the loss of the war on Jews. The theory was the armistice would not have happened had it not been for the revolution led by the socialists. And since the Jews are the ones who stand behind the socialists, therefore the Jews have betrayed us. And this is the as best we can determine it, our best guess is this is the source of Adolf Hitler's just burning thirst for revenge against the Jewish people. It also, essentially, the argument that the Jews were responsible for first socialism and then communism, then made persecution of the Jews and eventually murder of the Jews very attractive to the entire elite of German society, including the military, because there was this fantasy: if you could get rid of the Jews, you could permanently banish the terrifying threat of communist revolution. And you know, there are many different strands of antisemitism in every country and every age that are inspired from different reasons, but the version of antisemitism that led most directly to the Holocaust is the equation of Jews and Marxism. And this was basically the stated purpose for the extermination of the Jewish people as it was carried out during the Holocaust. It's not whether most of the people who actually participated in the murders fully bought into that theory. I'm kind of skeptical, and I have some additional perspectives to add, but let me give you a chance to jump in, because I haven't let you get a word in edgewise.
Oh, so. You're doing just fine. I was going to say that one of the things that is often not mentioned about World War II and about yes. Nazi Germany's role in it is that essentially Hitler began the war for a couple of reasons. One of them, to restore their national image after the humiliation of the First World War. But the biggest reason is, and the thing that he kept doing up until the very bitter end, was he was absolutely convinced that the Jews were a pestilence. If he couldn't chase them off, he'd kill them. And the more of them he killed, the happier he was. And that really seems to be the most, that was his strategy of the whole war. Capture a lot of countries so we can kill all their Jews. Then capture more, and we can kill all their Jews. We'll enslave the Slavs, because we don't think that they're not Aryans either. And therefore, we'll take over Europe, and then Europe will be in better hands, because we're the best people to run the entire continent.
A lot of what you say is very much on target. In particular, yeah, I don't know. I mean, Hitler is all the best evidence is that his thinking really didn't become genocidal until the end of 1940 or early 41. He didn't know, for example, in 39 that genocide was going to be his ultimate policy. But really, once he launches, you know, they invade the Soviet Union with the idea that they're going to kill basically 30 million of its Slavic inhabitants to help depopulate Western Russia and annex it all to be Germany's breadbasket and for all the natural resources to make Germany invulnerable long-term in the Darwinian struggle for survival among nations. But also, Hitler believes, because the Soviet Union is a communist state, then automatically it's led by Jews, even though it was not,
right.
Since Stalin had purged most of the Jewish members of the Soviet Communist Party. But in any case, that if he could destroy the Soviet Union, he would have destroyed the center of the worldwide Jewish Bolshevik conspiracy. And he also believed that Germany's other enemies in the war, Great Britain and our country, were in fact also controlled by Jews. And so the war was not just a military war against nation states, it was a war against the Jews. And for Hitler, the extermination of the Jewish people came to be a goal that was just as important, even more important, to winning the war. Indeed, in the last couple of years of the war, when it became clear that Germany was going to lose the war militarily, it was a consolation for him to feel that he was winning his war against the Jews and eradicating them.
Well, I would also like to mention, in case you're joining us late, we're talking to Dan McMillan, who's the author of How Could This Happen? Explain the Holocaust. It's from Basic Books, a member of the Perseus Books group. Has a PhD in German history from Columbia, a law degree from Fordham, has worked as a history professor, prosecuting attorney. What he has spent his life doing is studying to understand why the Holocaust happened. Was it a uniquely German thing? Do we need to worry about it? Is it like other genocides? Is it analogous to things that the United States has known about it and do anything about, for example? Is it analogous to the genocide of the Armenians by the Turks and so forth? More and more of the evidence, the longer into his book that I was reading, the more I began to realize that even though these other genocides are not to be discounted and certainly are heinous, they don't have the sort of angst that the Holocaust has, because the Holocaust was so deliberate and so scientific about its extermination. The Jews were treated as test subjects or as just material to be used and discarded as slave labor, or to be, after their death, their gold teeth were pulled out and so forth. The Jews essentially helped pay for their own mass destruction because they, all of their property, all of their money, all of their clothes even, was stolen by the Nazis and sold to help continue paying for exterminating more Jews, which has got to be the cruelest part. One of the points that you made in the book about Hitler is that he basically only had one skill, that he tried a lot of things and he was a failure at all of them. The only thing he could really do was be a very successful public speaker. He used that skill and the new inventions of the age, the new medium of movies, the new medium of radio, allowed him to project his personality into a country that was looking for somebody to come along and rescue them. And they essentially anointed him a minor deity because they were so sure that he was the guy that was going to lead them out of the doldrums of World War I and the Great Depression and make them a great nation.
No, that's a lot of truth. And the other component that makes possible this myth of Hitler's superhuman abilities, or even that he's an instrument of divine providence, which is what he believed about himself, was that through dumb luck, really, but rather than any skill of his own, he had a remarkable string of successes that only ended when the German armies failed to take Moscow in December of 1941. I mean, for one thing, that Germany goes from 30% unemployment to full employment by 1937. The German people don't understand this is because he's plowing so much money into arms manufacture because he's planning to take them into a war. If they'd known that, they would not have been happy with him at all because they did not want another war. But what they did know is they had their job back. And since Goebbels, who was this brilliant innovator in public relations, advertising, and propaganda, controlled all media in the country, he was able to present all of Hitler's successes in the best light possible and to sort of nurture this myth of his sort of superhuman greatness. And let me pivot from that to what I think is kind of I guess the easiest way or the most important takeaway that I want people to have that I think will help them feel that they understand this. I think that people, you know, professional historians who study it, find it incredibly difficult to explain in an accessible way why this has happened, and people that we try to explain it to have a hard time absorbing it because it's so easy to get to drown in the details. But there's one sort of central point that I mentioned earlier that I think is the most important sort of takeaway, and that is that one way of putting it is that the killers did this, and slaughter, this is not true of their Jewish victims, but also of 6 or 7 million Gentile victims who were murdered for various reasons, including 200,000 Germans with disabilities that they murdered just to save money, to not have to take care of them.
Right.
That the reason why, you know, one way of stating the cause is to say it happened because the killers saw no reason whatsoever to not do it, because they decided that individual human life was insignificant, and therefore the only thing that mattered was the goal of the German so-called race's long-term survival in this Darwinian struggle. And any life, including German life, if ending it would in any way advance that struggle, advance that goal, then it was a good thing to do. And I guess another way that I would put this, to kind of hammer home how brutal it is what we're talking about, if we could go back in time and ask these guys, why are you doing this? I'm very confident that most of them would respond by shrugging their shoulders and asking us, why not? They're just people. And the question then is, what factors came together in time to rob human life of all value in the minds of the ruling class of an advanced society? And you just, earlier, just a moment ago, put your finger on one of them. It's this deification of Hitler, which meant that nothing he commanded was subject to any kind of moral judgment. Indeed, Hitler was seen as the, as they put it in the German legal profession, the supreme judge of the nation. All law came from Hitler's will, and so if all law comes from the arbitrary will of an individual, there is no law. And that created, that gave for everyone who acted upon his orders a moral free pass to break every moral rule that they had ever been taught. And the two other factors that help explain this radical negation of our life's value is the massive slaughter of young men in the First World War, which 10 million young men killed, among them 2 million Germans, more than 2 million Germans. And if you, as a percentage of the German population, if you scale it up to our country today, it would be, Dave, as if we just came off a war where we lost 10 million killed in action. And try to think about how we would look at the world if that had happened. And the third, you already alluded to at the beginning, you talked about eugenics, which was an outgrowth or a branch of social Darwinist racism. It was this, it was something thought to be scientific certainty. It was this very simplistic, and we now know bankrupt, application of Darwin's theory of evolution to contemporary human society. And part of it was the idea that every nationality, ethnic group, was a distinct race with its own genetic signature, and that Germans, say, had evolved further from the apes than Poles and in a different way, and that there was this hierarchy of value among the so-called races, with many better than others, which opens the door to the idea that some Slavic peoples, for example, are of almost no value and can be killed without compunction, and that one nationality, the Jews, are genetically hardwired to behave destructively so that you have to eradicate them. And they spoke of the Jews as vermin in human form was the language. And so these three factors together, the way that the glorification of Hitler essentially erases moral norms, the scientific racism that assigns often very little value to many branches of humanity, and the cheapening of life as a consequence of the First World War, and also the violent backdrop of the Second, all the people killed in the Second World War as well, these come together to rob human life of all value. And that's only happened once in history at this moment. And that's kind of my argument about why I think that's the best explanation for why the Holocaust is the only historical event that frightens us, and which I think is also maybe the most important reason why it's the only historical event that people around the world want to deny happened.
Right.
You know, because, I mean, there are no French Revolution denialists out there. There are no American Civil War denialists, right? But Holocaust denial is a worldwide movement. And, look, the people who are peddling this mind poison, I think all of those people are just vicious anti-Semites of the worst kind. But I think that these lies that they sell fall on fertile ground because, you know, really, if someone could offer you, you know, a plausible reason for thinking that you and other human beings like you are not capable of this cruelty, it's not strange that you would want to believe that. I mean, I'm not condoning denial or defending people who buy into this, but in a way, it is just so terrifying that this is possible because, as I see it, Dave, it is a death threat to us all because it is a standing challenge to the value of my life, your life, the lives of all the people listening to our conversation, the life of every human being. And that, I think, is this special horror that has not been articulated very well, you know, by historians or anyone else who's teaching about the Holocaust. And I think it hasn't been articulated because it's so darn scary we don't want to look at it.
Yeah, as you point out toward the end of the book, no German who pulled a trigger or signed an order had reason to fear punishment if he refused to become a murderer. Understanding them should make us think twice before assuming we would have done better had we stood in their shoes. I think this is the danger of modernism, isn't it? That we're better people now than they were then. Well, the thing that makes the Holocaust scary is that at the time that they embraced all of this, that Germany was considered one of the most compassionate. It was not the most anti-Semite country in Europe.
That's right.
And
that's
it was,
right. Good you put that out.
Great educated people, very high standards of living, and so forth. And yet, the fact that people could do something terrible and not have to suffer any consequences, that becomes a whole different level of the carnage around the Crusades might be somewhat analogous, because there were people who basically thought, hey, if I participate in this, even if I kill a lot of people, it's okay because the church says that we'll all be forgiven of it. In a sense, the Church of Germany and its bishop, Adolf Hitler, said, it's okay, kill all you need, because that's what we need to make the world safe and pure.
That's such a great phrasing that I just heard from you, that Nazism is the Church of Germany and Adolf Hitler is the bishop or the pope.
Yeah.
And if he says it's okay. One thing I do want to do, though, however, I also want to say is, I mean, I think that what the Holocaust shows, and that passage you just read from the conclusion about we shouldn't assume that we would do better had we stood in their shoes, what I guess I would say, one important point to make is that if you teach people the wrong ideas, if you put them under the wrong government, namely a dictatorship, if you put them in the wrong circumstances, namely a major war, there is no limit to how low we can sink morally. But I don't want people to look at the Holocaust and then embrace pessimism about our society, our civilization, about human nature, because since the Second World War, throughout the Western world, including our country, we have been, you know, not perfectly teaching our people, teaching ourselves more of the right ideas, that racism is wrong, for example. We've been building the right kind of government, which is making political systems more democratic for the most part. And we in the First World have avoided war on the scale of World War II. And I believe that our societies today, American society, German, all of our friends and allies in Europe and Asia and Canada and so on, that we have built human societies that are on balance morally superior to any human societies that came before. And I think it's really important. The Holocaust is this warning that we can't take the value of human life for granted. We must always be vigilant to assert it and affirm it and defend it. On the other hand, this should not be taken as grounds for pessimism about the human future. I'm a big believer in humanity's capacity for progress. I believe human beings are more good than they are bad. And also pessimism is just not very useful. Because
right.
If you want to make the world a better place, you've got to have some faith in yourself. And
yeah.
So it's a balancing act. It's like I don't want anyone to forget the Holocaust. In fact, I feel like I'm trying to help people more fully understand just how horrifying it was. And on the other hand, I think it's one important conclusion of my book, is that for this to happen in what may have been our most advanced society, it wasn't enough for one thing to go wrong or two or three. It took at least a dozen factors. They were all necessary. It was a kind of perfect storm. And so it's a part of our potential and it's a warning, but I don't think it's, frankly, even a good excuse for pessimism about our future.
I think that's the best way to end this. And Dan, usually at this point, I ask my guests if there was anything that you wanted me to ask that I neglected to ask.
You know, you asked really terrific questions, Dave. I have to tell you, I can't. At this point, I cannot think of anything important that you missed. You really kind of cut to the heart of a whole bunch of issues, and I really appreciate that.
Well, sure. Well, having your book to read makes all the difference. We want people to get copies of your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think online is the best bet at this. I mean, you can always go to your bookstore and request that they order it for you, but the book was published in 2014, so, you know, bookstores just generally keep stuff that's more recent on the shelves.
True.
On Amazon, it is available. There's an Audible book version. I'm pretty sure it's on Kindle, and then the hardcover, which I had sent you.
Right. But do you have a website?
I do, and actually what I'd like to give our audience is my political website, because my occupation now, my full-time job, is I lead a nonpartisan effort to try to get big money out of politics, to bring
Ooh.
Back government by the people here in our country.
Amen.
Which is something I feel good about.
Yeah, me too.
But on the website, there is biographical information on me and my book. So my organization is called Save Democracy in America. The website URL is unfortunately a little long. It's savedemocracyinamerica.org, savedemocracyinamerica.org. Although if you just Google Dan McMillan Money and Politics or Dan McMillan Holocaust, I'll turn up. And thank you for that, the opportunity to make my book available to your audience.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Dan. It's a remarkable book, and I think you did an incredible job in researching and showing all of these factors had to be in place for it to occur when it did and where it did. And I've read a bunch of books.
Thank you so much for that praise. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, having your book is really a great read and should really answer a lot of questions that people have. So thank you for making time to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dave. I really appreciate it.
Our thanks to our guest, Dr. Dan McMillan, the author of How Could This Happen? Explaining the Holocaust from Basic Books. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio station or on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.